There we go. Welcome. It's Big Jim's Garage. One more here before we take a little break for the holiday. We'll be talking Sequoias and Corollas and stick shifts and everything else. But first, we got to get into the story. Formula One. Crazy race. The final race in Abu Dhabi. Max and Lewis. Worldwide drama. Everybody was watching it. And David Hobbs. That David Hobbs has been so gracious to allow me to wake him up so I can bring him on in Big Jim's Garage. Let's talk F1 with Mr. David Hobbs. Ladies and gentlemen, David Hobbs, how are you, sir?
I'm very good, thank you. Very well indeed. Considering the time again, and everything.
I know. I appreciate you getting up to do this, David. And I'm still trying to process everything that happened in Abu Dhabi. And the first thing is, have you ever... I've never seen
about 10 million other people.
Yeah, I don't know that I've ever seen a sport where there's so much transparency, where I can hear arguments between the teams and the race director. I'm not sure that I like that. And Michael Massey was just in a horrible position.
Well, I think the FIA is going to have to take a big step back and look in the mirror and decide which direction they're going in, because last week's race in Saudi Arabia was a fiasco as well.
Yeah.
With the same sort of thing. I mean, there is the supposed referee, Michael Massey, calling the team and saying, well, what do you think? Well, I mean, that's not how you control a sport. And I think that the decisions made have been appalling all through the year, really. You know, one day you get penalized for pushing somebody off, like poor old Lando Norris in Austria, when he didn't actually push Perez off. Perez tried an impossible move around the outside, went off the road, and they gave Lando Norris a 5-second penalty. Then when that in Brazil, when Max Verstappen pushed, took about an acre and a half off the road himself, pushing Hamilton wider and wider and wider and wider, and the stewards decided no further action needed. So obviously there has to be some sort of clarification of these rules, and it's unfortunately it's Michael Massey's job to do so. And I think he's got himself in a position now where it's very difficult for him to make or change decisions. Well, he obviously can't change decisions that have been made already.
Right.
But they are going to have to come together and really settle on these rules where they really are.
So now, for folks that don't understand this, David, though, but the stewards will change from race to race, right?
Yes. And my ex-broadcast partner, Steve Matchett, I see yesterday in a tweet, said this is the one. And he and I used to say this 20 years ago when we started working together on Speed Vision, that the stewards should be a body that move around. We shouldn't have Brazilian stewards in Brazil and Dutch stewards in Holland and so on and so forth.
Right.
Should be a group of traveling judges. They have improved slightly in as much as they do have one steward now per race who's an ex-driver, but it's always a different driver. I think it's that is something that needs to be looked into as well.
It was confusing as well because I was thinking about this. This is almost like being a kid and you go to one parent and Michael Massey says, no, you're grounded for the weekend. And then all of a sudden your mom comes in a week, you know, a day later and says, no, you're grounded for a month. Like, he makes a deal, and then all of a sudden Max gets a 5-second penalty. Or, you know, during the race, I really don't understand sometimes who has the authority to impose penalties on the drivers. Is it Massey and the stewards, or is it both?
Well, Massey says it's the stewards, and he is just the sort of messenger. But it's not obviously not quite as simple as that.
Right.
And that is another thing that's going to be resolved one way or the other, because the build-up to yesterday's race worldwide was absolutely incredible. I mean, like the USA Today had a half a page on Thursday.
Yes.
And USA Today, you're lucky to see the results in the results column on a Monday. And here they devoted a half page to this amazing championship that was coming down to the wire. Jeremy Clarkson in the London Times yesterday had a two-page article going on about this race, how he'd been to various other meetings like the Horse Racing Association in England, and all they could talk about was Max and Lewis. And so it attracted enormous attention and probably had a huge worldwide audience, a lot of whom had seen a Formula One race before. And when they heard all the shenanigans that were going on between the teams and Michael Massey and the stewards room, they must have been thinking, what the hell? How do these guys run this? This isn't being run at all. This is just sort of ad hoc decisions. First of all, Michael Massey's not going to let the pace car, the lapped cars go around the pace car. Then he decides he will, but he only sends some of them through, the ones that are, in fact, between Lewis Hamilton and Max Verstappen, and leaves the others hanging out to dry on the line, and basically hands the race to Max Verstappen.
Right.
And that's how people are going to see it. I mean, you know, they took a, you know, Red Bull took a gamble in coming in for that pit stop and putting the red tyres on. However, they were in a no-win situation. They were 11 seconds down with four laps to go, so there's no way they were going to make it up. So they thought they'd make up as much time as they possibly could and hope for a miracle. And, of course, hope for a miracle did arise. People say, well, why didn't Hamilton change his tyres as well? But, of course, it was too late for him to change his tyres because that would have put him behind.
Yeah.
And then that would have won the race as well. So the whole thing was a complete balls up, really. And of course, poor old Hamilton had driven his heart out for 57 laps, gets passed on the last lap, but his tyres are already 35 or 40 laps old. And, you know, the Max Verstappen's on brand new red tyres, which is second the lap quicker anyway. So, yeah, the whole thing was, I think, most, most unsatisfactory. Of course, a lot of people are going to say, well, good God, what's Lewis got to complain about? He's already got 7 championships, not enough. I think it left a very bad taste in a lot of mouths.
Why didn't they red flag it? I mean, if you really, and I know Massey had said before the race, he told him he wants to finish this under green, then red flag it and stop it with 5 laps left, and then clear the track, and then give him a chance to get after it that way. Wouldn't that have been a better option?
Absolutely. Of course, that's a bit of 2020 hindsight, but that's what a lot of experts are saying now, which would have been the best way to do it. Or, regrettably, which has happened many times before, they should have finished it under the pace car.
Yeah.
And that would have been it. And, of course, that would have been a very justifiable result for a lot of people because Lewis Hamilton had led 99% of the race. So, not exactly a shock finish. But the way they did it and the way they managed it, if you want to call it managed, was very unsatisfactory. And I think it will go down as one of the biggest cock-ups, basically, in Formula One racing ever.
So going forward, and we hear so much about the new car, the new platform for next year. It's still Max versus Lewis, isn't it? I mean, I know we have other amazing drivers, but is there realistically, could McLaren next year stick their nose in with Red Bull and Mercedes to compete for championships? Could Ferrari have a bounce back, or am I just putting too much into the new platform?
No, I think you're right. I mean, obviously Formula One is an incredible sport. And again, as Steve Matteo always used to point out, you know, you take IndyCar where they have some incredibly close races and they have multiple different winners and Formula One. And yet Formula One cars are all designed and built by different people with different engines, designed and built by different people. And yet when you see the grid, there is like 0.4 of a second between first and 10th.
Right.
How do everybody, you know? So, yes, there's a good chance that with the new rules, which hopefully will improve overtaking possibilities with the downforce redistributed coming from tunnels under the car more as well as air going over the top of the car. Hopefully that will make it more competitive. And, yeah, I mean, I think that McLaren has shown tremendous form this year. And so Ferrari, Carlos Sainz ended up third on the podium. And, they're not... I mean, when you look at it, they are only 4 or 5 tenths of a lap slower. But, of course, 4 or 5 tenths of a lap slower over a 70-lap race suddenly, you know, you're 30 seconds behind. And that has been the most amazing thing this year, is that, as Martin Brundle said yesterday in the broadcast, you've got to take your hat off, your hats off to these two guys. He said, look, as usual, here we are. We're only like 15 laps into the race, and they're already 20 seconds ahead of the rest of the field.
Stunning.
And as you say, the rest of the field is not made up of a bunch of bozos. I mean, these are all absolutely top-line drivers. And so, yeah, I'm looking, hoping for big things next year. But, quite frankly, with those two drivers still in there, I think it will turn into another Max and Lewis show.
I love, even yesterday, watching the race, David Hobbs with us, that it was so interesting, even watching their racing lines, how different they are on the track. Their styles and obviously their personalities and stuff, but the way they drive the cars and the way they push it, it feels like Max is willing to go. He drives that thing like a go-kart, the way he throws it in there. And Lewis drives just as hard, but it feels like it's more composed when he's doing laps.
I think you're absolutely right. And of course, Hamilton has got a very long record now. I mean, his first year was 2007. Here we are at the end of 2021. And he's had very, very few crashes, very, very few run-ins with other drivers, whereas Max has had run-ins with other drivers from his very first season, including whipping the wing off the front of Kimi Raikkonen's Ferrari in Hungary back in, like, 2016. So, yeah, I mean, Max is, a balls-out driver, and always says he'll take no quarter. But, of course, there comes a point when if you're up against another guy who's the same, you're both out. And that is something that Hamilton this year has been extraordinarily adept in avoiding. they take each other out because there have been lots of opportunities this year for him to say, well, if you think you're going to barge your way through, how about me barging back? And, of course, it would have ruined the race for everybody because they'd have both been out.
Well, Lewis could have dumped him in that last lap.
Yep, he could have done. He could have easily done it. And I think if it had been Max, he probably would have done. But if Max had been, as it was on, well, of course, on even points, if Max
had... Yeah, Max would have won, right? Yeah.
Would have won. Won more races.
Does Max change because of this? I've always seen, you see the evolution of drivers, where he becomes less of just a flat-out driver and more of a, I hate the word personality, but a champion. Do you think he changes because of this?
I think he will a bit. I mean, everybody does when they get older and more mature, as the brain, because, as the experts always say with gun control, it's all very well having 16-year-olds with guns because 16-year-olds, their brains haven't fully developed yet.
Right.
And it's the same with when Max started for Red Bull, he was only 17. So, now he's a mature man of 24. Yeah, I think he will definitely... not slow down. I think he won't slow down at all. That's where the top guys come out. People like Schumacher. If you talk to Steve Matchett again, Steve Matchett says Schumacher in his first couple of years wrecked about 20 cars. But he soon got through that stage, but didn't lose his speed, just lost the recklessness. And that's what I think will happen to Max. And I think he'll be a tremendous threat for the world championship for another 10 or 15 years.
All right, now this is me being silly, but I was thinking about Lewis and how amazing he is. But I remember a couple of years ago when Charles Leclerc went to Ferrari, and we all thought he was going to be the number two guy, and Vettel would teach him, and he'd work his way up. And then Charles, by halfway through the season, was the number one guy. Can you, in your mind's eye, imagine George Russell doing something similar at Mercedes?
Well, judging from his performance in those two races last year,
he's fast.
He could be right on the line, right on the limit right away, yes. So he could present a huge threat to Lewis, and it will be very interesting to see how that evolves, I must say. And because Bottas was a big disappointment yesterday, I mean, just straight away,
gone.
Didn't qualify well, yeah. And slipped down to eighth and ninth, and having trouble getting past people like Tsunoda and Norris and them. So I think that Russell will be a much stronger partner. But how long he will remain a partner, it's going to be very interesting to see, isn't it?
Yeah, well, with Nico, because I know Nico Rosberg, I mean, he didn't want to be the number two guy. And after a while, it created, I wouldn't say an unhealthy environment, but as a fan watching it, you could tell they didn't get along.
Oh, well, I mean, and I have a horrible feeling that might well happen next year, too. And the thing about Max is that car is a bit of a weird thing to drive. And so nobody else can even come close to Max's time. So the issue doesn't arise for Max, but it will for Lewis.
It's so compelling right now, David. I mean, what's going on in F1 and how this is becoming a world sport, especially here in North America. I've got my co-host that I do a radio show here in Detroit, and he's talking to me about F1. He's 31 years old, and he doesn't watch racing at all. But F1 and the stories have compelled him, and he's asking me questions about it. He wants to know more about Max and Lewis, and it is amazing how this sport is just set to take off here in the States.
Yeah, I think it really is. And when they have a new race in Miami next year, I think in the end, I think Roger Penske will have another Formula One race at the at Indianapolis, which I still think was a tremendous venue for Formula One. The track's not the best track in the world, for sure.
Right.
But it's a hell of a lot safer than that thing at Saudi Arabia. When I first saw practice from Saudi Arabia, I said, what's the FIA thinking about? They shouldn't be racing here. I mean, they're averaging 157 through all those blind, twisty, 200-mile-an-hour corners.
It looked like a slot car track.
It's ridiculous. I mean, it is so unsafe. So unsafe. And as we saw, multiple red flags, multiple safety cars.
Yeah.
The Formula 2 race only lasted 6 laps, and then it had to be called off.
That was the easiest money I've ever made online gambling, David, was I bet, will there be a safety car in Saudi Arabia? I'm like, well, yeah. I got that in 2 laps. And my friend's like, did you bet that? I'm like, oh, yeah. Are you kidding me?
Absolutely. So I think I think Formula One in America will finally, get into the top 4 or 5 of the watched sport.
Yeah,
which will make a huge difference to Formula One.
I've always wondered what would the arc of Penske Motorsports be racing if Mark Donohue lived, if he didn't die so tragically in a crash. Because what they were doing, and I don't think people realize what an amazing driver Mark was.
No, he was, he was a tremendous driver. And, I drove with him for a year with that Ferrari 512 when Mark and I shared it in the World Championship, the Sports Car World Championship back in 1971. He was a good teammate, and he was a very, very good, he was a great engineer too, so he was good at setting the car up.
Yeah.
Him and Don Cox worked together all the time and made an incredible car. So I think Mark Donohue was a bit underrated. And he always felt tremendous loyalty to Roger, enormous loyalty, and just wondered whether he was, and he worried all the time that he was letting Roger down, which of course he was in fact helping to build what became the Roger Penske Empire.
Yeah. And then the last thing, and I appreciate the time, David, doing this, and so much about F1, but the Andretti story, I don't think it's over with Michael getting a team. Is that just something that I always wonder, like when stuff like that gets leaked in the media, is that them trying to work out a deal that they can't get done privately?
I don't know. We didn't hear much about it, really. We kept on hearing it was happening. But I think the powers that be in Formula One are very weird about America and American drivers. I mean, the fact that if you win an IndyCar race, it still won't get you a super license is absolutely absurd.
Amen. Amen.
Completely absurd. And it is way too sort of European and now European and Asian centric. And I don't like the way a lot of things are going in Formula One, but I think that's a particularly bad example. And I think that a lot of the people in Formula One just didn't want an American owning a team.
And like today, well, even as we speak, Pato O'Ward is getting his some seat time with McLaren, and we've heard about Herta and those guys. But is that just kind of like one dance, now get off the dance floor and let us get back to what we do?
Well, I don't quite know, because Brian Herta, Herta
is amazing.
Beat Lando Norris in one of those junior championships, like not Formula 3, but European Renault International or whatever the formula was.
Right.
But Herta beat Lando Norris. So, I mean, we know that when we know what a driver he is, he's tremendous. Herta's tremendous. Pato O'Ward's tremendous. I'd be really interested to see how Pato O'Ward gets on. I'm looking forward to that a lot.
I pay money to watch Pato. I told him that when here in Detroit for the Grand Prix, and he looked at me and goes, what? I said, I'll pay money to watch you drive. That guy just hangs it out there every lap.
Doesn't he ever? Absolutely incredible. And that Pelot, he's the current champion. I mean, he's not very shabby either.
No, that's the IndyCar. I mean, I think that that's kind of lockstep, the open wheel influence here in the States. The IndyCar, whether I don't think they like being referred to as a feeder for F1, but it definitely influences your passion for open wheel racing.
Yes, of course it does. Yeah. No, I think IndyCar the last few years has been absolutely extraordinary. We've just had some great seasons. Really, really, really close races for the championship.
Well, I'd be last thing, David, I have to tell you, your book is amazing. I love it.
Oh, look.
And, of course, I've sent you pictures on social media, on Twitter. Every race that I watch, I have my Habbo coffee mug.
Oh, good. Yeah.
I do. That's my thing.
Well, if any of your listeners want a copy of the book, they just go email Habbo book, H-O-B-B-O book, all one word, at davidhobbs.com, and I'll send you a signed copy.
There you go. David, anyway. it's a wonderful book, and we have so many gearheads, obviously, here in the Motor City. And, hey, we're getting back to a street circuit here in a couple of years.
Yes.
Yeah.
I saw that. Is that going to happen?
Yes, it's done. It won't be this year. It'll be in 23. They're going to go back to, it's pretty close to what they used to drive in downtown Detroit, but they're going to be back on Jefferson in front of the Rensen, the long straightaway, everything else. So, yeah, we'll be racing back in downtown Detroit in 2 years.
Oh, good. I'm looking forward to seeing that, because I raced on that original track in a Trans Am car in 1984, and I thought it was a hell of a track. It was very bumpy, but it was a hell of a track.
Well, and none of the manhole covers came up, so that's good.
No.
Yeah. All right. David, be well. All the best to you and your family during the holidays, and appreciate everything you do. And, yeah, we're all going to kind of digest this F1 finale and move forward.
Okay, well, thanks very much for calling and waking me up in the morning. Have a good day.
All the best. Bye.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most of us, Keith Urban also has a bucket list. You may be surprised to learn what is and is not on his. Text Keith to 45911 to read and learn more about the central theme of Keith's bucket list. Get a link to the story sent right to your phone when you text Keith to 45911. Go inside country music at BackstageCountry.com.
Okay, bye-bye.
David Hobbs, Habbo book at davidhobbs.com. If you got a friend who's into racing, that is such a cool book. Thank you, David, for the time. Couple little quick notes before we put a bow on this. Learn about Mark Donohue, when we were talking about during the conversation. When you realize what Roger Penske, like we were saying, Roger Penske, and I think Donohue was the driver that Penske was going to be before he got into us automotive sales and stuff. If you don't know that, at one point, Roger Penske was actually driver of the year in Sports Illustrated in the 60s. And they told him, you need to chill and quit doing that and focus on what you're doing behind the scenes. So I think it was Chevy, wasn't it? Yeah, kind of told him that you need to focus on being a salesman. And that's where it went. But it's an interesting story about Mark. I've always thought there'd be an interesting movie, too, but that's just me being a gearhead. A couple quick notes before we put a bow on this. Had a chance to drive the Sequoia Nightshade from our friends at Toyota. 381 horsepower V8, tows 7,400 pounds, three rows. It's huge, it's big, and it's fun to drive. It was interesting driving the Sequoia because, I always joke about SUVs being like belly buttons. Everybody's got one. But there's something about the Sequoia, and this Nightshade version looks great. It's a great look. Now, tech-wise, inside the Sequoia, yeah, the Toyota stuff's getting kind of agey, if that's a word. I'm not going to say outdated, but it's kind of middle of the pack. Does that make sense? It's all right. Could be better. But this is a beast, man. This is an all-season one. We're taping these here in Detroit. This is the kind of vehicle I would take up north and I wouldn't blink. I'd pull my camper, I wouldn't blink. Boats, wouldn't blink. Rain, snow, sleet, chickens falling from the sky, wouldn't blink. You feel big in this in the Sequoia. It's got that stance, too. I always wrestle with sometimes they take large SUVs and they try to make them look small. Don't do that. Don't do that. Do you. Be who you're going to be. So often we try to take cars and trucks and we try to morph them into something else. The Sequoia is what it is. Is it a dated platform? Yeah, maybe a little. But I'm telling you, it works. It's a big boy, man. You are driving that's a big boy car right there. But I loved it. Fun to drive. And again, the power plant that Toyota has in the TRD power plant is fantastic. It's fantastic. And you can just feel it in there. So that one, yeah, the tech could be better. You could do something. You can get, if you're looking just for tech to do that, yeah, you can make better options out there. But I'm telling you right now, the Sequoia is a big boy. That's a big boy. What do you call it? Your big boy pants? Put on your big boy pants when you drive that Sequoia Nightshade. And again, looks, styling, but that there's a level of confidence when you're driving the Sequoia. It's an all-season confidence that I don't get in a lot of vehicles. It's few and far between, but it's pretty damn impressive. And the other one I wanted to mention from Toyota, my friend's Toyota, the Corolla hatchback, the XSE. A little sporty, but here's the deal. I'm 6'5". I'm a big guy. I need to lose, like, I don't know, a small child in weight. But I'm all upper body. So when I get some of these smaller cars, I'm like, oh, I'm going to have to wedge myself in there with a pry bar. Didn't have to. Hopped right in this Corolla hatchback. It's a stick shift. That's the thing over to the right with the knobs. But here's the thing about it. Great mileage. It's got a little pep to it. It's got all the bells and whistles you need. $25,000. Go play that game sometime. How many cars can you find that are $25,000? The answer is not many. And a Corolla is such a great car. It's perfect for this. If I sound like I'm in a good mood, I am. When I drive Toyota cars, I notice time and time again, the quality and the build is right there. They nail that. And the other thing you'll notice, and when you're driving a stick shift, even in a small car, I thought I'd get kind of frustrated with city driving because, you know, you're dropping into first. Nah, not really. Very forgiving stick. But it even had a little bit of pep. Now, do you need the performance version? Probably not. It's fun to have. Didn't need it. I've never really, you know, small car. Remember, I was just talking about be who you are. You're a Corolla. Don't worry about it. I'm not drag racing anybody in that car. I'm just having fun. You don't need to advertise. You got a little pop in it. That's okay. My buddy had a Peugeot back in the day when I was in the service, and that thing was a total sleeper. Love sleeper cars. The Corolla hatchback is a sleeper because of the price point and what you get for it. But $25,000, all day. All day. All right. Next time, we'll be talking Wagoneers. I finished my seat time in the Wagoneer. I'll have the Grand Wagoneer, the Obsidian. We'll get our hands on that. That'll be coming up in a couple weeks here. It's a Jeep that doesn't say Jeep. I don't think I could find. I found one Jeep thing when you turn the car on, but on the outside, no. But it's nice. Oh, I'd be very nervous if I'm a General Motors. We'll talk about that. All right, thanks to our friends at Toyota for the Sequoia and the Corolla as well. Thank you to David Hobbs. If you want to follow me on Twitter, at Hi Big Jim. Make sure you subscribe as well here. Appreciate you guys. Be safe. God bless. Old people in cars.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Picking five of Carrie Underwood's best music videos was no easy task, but after some debate, we landed on five we believe rise to the top. Did Carrie's 2014 hit Something in the Water make our top five? Find out when you text Carrie to 45911 and scroll through the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Carrie to 45911 to get your eyes on our favorite Carrie Underwood music videos.